I'd like to start by acknowledging
the traditional custodians of this land
and pay my respects to their elders
past, present,
and to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded.
Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. Hi, welcome to the Colour Cycle podcast. I'm Lena Nahluz, coming to you from the Barramattagal land of the Darug Nation with an interview series called Pace Setters, chronicling the stories of pioneering artists from culturally diverse backgrounds. So how much do you know about Japanese migration to Australia? It's a history little known, even amongst the Japanese diaspora here. And that's why a few years ago, Nikkei Australia was set up as a digital platform to preserve and promote the legacy of the Japanese diaspora in Australia and to connect Japanese Australians with each other. And it's unearthed a remarkable history. Nikkei Australia was where New South Wales art gallery creative producer Yuki Kawakami met artist Mayu Kanamori, a storyteller who works with performance, theatre and the visual arts. With over 30 years of practice, Kanamori has established herself as a multidisciplinary artist and heritage interpreter, working on site-specific projects across the country. In this conversation with Yuki Kawakami, she explores questions of identity, history and collaborative projects with First Nations communities. She begins by telling Kawakami what Melbourne's Footscray was like in 1981 when she first arrived there on a student visa.
Well, when I first moved to Melbourne, I went to school in Footscray. It was called the Footscray Institute of Technology, and it was an eye-opener because Footscray was a very, very multicultural place at the time. It is still now too, but it's gentrified. At that time, it was a working class migrants hub. The Vietnamese people had moved in. Before that, it was the Greeks and the Italians. And I was surprised to see how different it was to being in a school in Japan full of Americans.
Mm.
Australians spoke English, but very different people.
Yeah. And so when you arrived in Australia, did you have a sense of wanting to stay here, or did you travel back to Japan? I'm guessing that your family was still based in Japan.
That's correct. My family is still in Japan. And when I first came out here, I certainly did want to stay for some time. I didn't know that I would end up being here all this time.
Mm. So I would really love to ask about your photographic practice. Photography is a predominant medium, and what drew you to photography? When did you first start using the camera, and what have been the key influences in your practice?
So when I moved to Sydney, I was working in sales and marketing in a hotel chain. But my partner at the time, he was a journalist. So he then had a camera who he encouraged me to use. And a little bit later on, he was posted to Tokyo for his journalism career. And I went with him. And that's when I started taking photographs whilst I was in Japan with him. And it was handy for him because he had a photographer on hand. And it was good for me because when I got back to Australia 3 years later, after being in Japan for 3 years with a journalist partner, I had a portfolio of published works.
Is this your work, The Unseen Faces of Japan?
Unseen Faces of Japan was a result of the 3 years I was in Japan and the photographs I took, partly for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers and the Good Weekend magazine, but also there are photographs I took out of my own interest as well, and that became a collection of photographs called The Unseen Faces of Japan.
I would like to talk a little bit about The Heart of the Journey from 2000, because it's a performance work that follows the story of Broome-born woman Lucy Dan, who discovered in her 20s that her biological father was a Japanese man who had worked in Broome's pearling industry. And I think through photography and also sound recordings, so many interviews that you conducted with Lucy, it really captures the intimacy and the closeness that you have with your subjects. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that project.
Well, Heart of the Journey was a result of, well, things happening one after another. I went to Broome in 1998 as a holiday, and on the way there, on the plane, I read a book which was written by Fujio Nakano, a Japanese author, about an Aboriginal woman and a Japanese pearl diver who was living in Broome. And basically it was their love story. It was a non-fiction love story. And so, you know, I read this on the plane. It was one of those things that opened my eyes to this place I was going on a holiday. I had not only Japanese history, but history that crossed between Japanese peoples and Australian Indigenous peoples. And it really got me interested. If there was a love story, there would be children, was what I thought. So while I was there, instead of lounging around, which I had intended to do, I picked up the phone book and started looking for Japanese surnames. And I started photographing a group of people who I met in Broome that had a mixed heritage between Japanese and Indigenous. I just say Indigenous because they're Nyurunyur people, Bari people, Yaru people. There are many different groups of people in Broome. And as I photographed them, just portraits, how they looked like. And I met Lucy after I got back to Sydney. You know, I send everybody photos. And Lucy was the only person that wrote back to say thank you for the photos. And from there, we wrote a few letters. And she had told me about various foods they eat, for an example, that was Japanese influenced. For an example, they eat the intestines of the greenback turtle, and they eat it with soy sauce and sometimes with wasabi. So there was this cross-cultural experience to be had between Japanese peoples and Aboriginal peoples. And to experience that and to write about it for the Japanese version of a Qantas in-flight magazine called Camping with Aboriginal People in Dampier Peninsula. So I spent 10 days camping with them, and that's when I learned a lot more about Lucy, her Japanese heritage, and she said to me she wanted to go to Japan. So I said, okay, well, next time I'm going, I will let you know, and you can come. So she said she needed to put some money together. And she did. One day she wrote, said, I've got enough money together. It's only about 1 year later. When do you want to go to Japan? And I was going to Japan in May to exhibit some photographs, May that year. So I said, I'm going. And she said, I'm coming. I want to find my father. And so that's how it happened.
Yeah, I really love the way that you documented the process and the relationship and even the correspondence between yourself and Lucy, which was all handwritten letters. And it really made me reflect on, I guess, the fast-paced nature in which we work nowadays and to, you know, recent events of COVID, that it's so important for us to really slow down and appreciate what's happening between us and all around us. And I think that really resonated with me.
I think many stories unfold itself over time. And if we can be patient and continue to document those stories, eventually it comes out, but often it's not instantaneous. especially when we're working with people.
I was actually thinking about the format in which this was presented as well. And it had a very deep sense of nostalgia for me. And I was thinking about it and I thought, oh, maybe this looks a bit like Japanese storytelling, like Kamishibai, which is a paper play. It's a type of street theatre and storytelling told through a set of illustrated boards by a narrator. And I just wondered, looking back on it now, because it's a project from nearly 20 years ago, like how do you interpret that work now, and how has your work progressed since then?
The method doesn't count. And yes, I have thought about it, about showing still photographs and adding narration in it in a storytelling way is just like Kamishibai. I have thought of that. But the truth of the matter is that's not the effect I was trying to get. I was just using mediums that I am able to use. Mm-hmm. And at the time, because it was documenting a journey, the using the video, moving image, as opposed to still photographs, could have been more apt. But I was already a photographer at the time. And I was a little bit not confident to use a video camera. There were heavy things at the time. Mm. Nowadays, it's very different. And so it was easier to just use the recorder in still photographs. And, well, I just scrambled it together to tell that story. Basically, I came back with a whole bunch of images and a whole bunch of recordings. And then from there, I took the recordings to ABC, Radio National, who helped me edit it. Over the years, I have learned to use video. I have learned to edit video as well. I have also worked more extensively on stage, whether it's my live narration or working with actors. But what hasn't changed is that I just want to tell that story, and the medium doesn't count. I just tend to use whatever is available, whatever I can get my hands on, and whatever I think is doable at the time.
With this work, it really demonstrated the dialogue and the inclusive process between you and Lucy as artists, both contributing to the narrative of the story. I was wondering if you could expand on this process of creative collaboration.
I think everybody brings in their strengths and weaknesses into a project if you're working on it together, including me. And, well, bringing in your strengths is easy, but when we bring our own weaknesses, that's when, if we could, through the collaborative process, be loving of each other and supporting of each other, whether it's a large group or small group, then those weaknesses that we bring to it actually can become a strength if you work with other people and if you can be honest about your weaknesses. And so therefore, when I'm collaborating with somebody, I think my first instinct is I've got to become friends with them so that they can accept my weakness. And I think that's what I did with Lucy, was I became friends first. And she had her fears and I had mine. There were differences between us, but we did have a goal in mind, which was to see if we could find her father, and that we would document it no matter what happens. And we didn't know what was going to happen. When we got to Japan, we knew where her father lived, but we didn't know if he would see her. So it was a risk in a way. We could have gone there and she may have become very hurt because he may have not said he wanted to see her. But well, it's less frightening if you've got someone you're working with and willing to support each other there.
Mm. So I felt that there was a great sense of trust in each other that really came through in this work. And I also wondered, are you still in contact with Lucy? What is she doing now?
Lucy is now in Broome. She was in Broome then, but since then she lived in Perth for a while. We do keep in touch. The last she was working with a social service sector, working with Aboriginal people, like a support, administrative and support role. But yeah, she's gone on to do her master's degree, and yeah, her children have all grown up. And she's still with her husband, and we haven't spoken probably for about 6 months now, but we do talk to each other. And yeah, I'm her honorary sister and she's my honorary sister, so her kids say hello to me on Facebook. I think about how do migrants become part of a country, the host country, that's beyond citizenship or beyond even being born there. There are all these thoughts about whose country is this country with a capital C? How do you become part of it? And in Australia, because the history is still evolving, how does a yellow person come into this dialogue that's being about whose country is it, whose land is it, and how do we share, how do we become part of it, how do we belong? That's been going on between white fellas and black fellas, or yellow fellas that's just come in. How do we take part in that conversation? I think a lot about whether, as newcomers, we are walking in without prior knowledge of what existed and just kind of brashly go our daily lives and without noticing its implications to people who were here before us. I think a lot about that.
Yeah.
I think a lot about how migrants could speak up. I think a lot about how we could change some of the imbalances. But before I do, I better have a think about how it is to belong to this place.
That's really interesting because reflecting on my upbringing here in the 90s, where Aboriginal history wasn't taught at all, really. And as an adult, reflecting on that and relearning history and what it means to people like me and us and migrants here, and how can we advocate for the wider community and also First Nations people as well. And I think that it's an important issue that a lot of Japanese people, I'm not sure, really engage in those conversation. What do you think, Maya-san?
I think that the Japanese community in Australia generally doesn't involve themselves in any social and political discourse that goes on in Australia. It's easy to put that down to, well, they're not interested in politics or they're not interested in social affairs. But I think a lot has to do with the fact that the Japanese community, majority of them in Australia, don't take up Australian citizenship, unlike other migrant groups. And there is a reason for it, and it's because Japan as a country, a nation, doesn't allow dual citizenship. So if you become an Australian, you lose your Japanese passport. So there's no political power because you don't have citizenship. You don't vote. So it's like there's a lot of Japanese people here, but they're not, are they not interested, or is it a result of not taking up citizenship?
Mm.
I'm not sure which comes first, but I think it's related.
Mm. That's a really interesting observation. And I have to speak from a personal level where I have still kept my Japanese citizenship, despite the fact that I've been living here for over 30 years now. And it is frustrating that I don't have that voice in political decisions, even though I feel like I'm very engaged with the discourse in my personal and work or everyday life. And why it's so challenging to come to terms with my identity in Australia.
I'm rethinking national borders now. Mm. What does this all mean? I am very, I guess, anti-nationalistic in a way because of that global education I received.
Yeah.
I learned from basically rich Americans, because if they're sending their kids to the American school in Japan, they're working for the big corporations or whatever. So I learned from, you know, relatively well-off Americans that what all the bad things that happened during World War II was due to nationalism, the phonetic nationalism of the Japanese. So I've kind of grown to dislike nationalism. So then, would I swear allegiance to one country and forfeit another? Or I just happen to be born Japanese, but, you know, it's a very difficult topic that I'm still thinking through.
Just with the direction in which this conversation is going, I want to talk about Yasukichi Murakami through a distant lens, which was a theatre performance from 2015 performed by Arisa Yura, Kuni Hashimoto, Yumi Umiumare, and Terumi Narushima. There's a quote that really stood out to me, and Arisa Yura, who plays you in this piece, says, "The silent voices of the Japanese in Australia, I keep hearing them. Voices of the many forgotten Japanese who came here." And it made me think about the Japanese who are currently here, although you were speaking of the Japanese who were here, who have deceased. It made me really reflect on us, the Nikkei Australians here. Could you please tell me how, as a Japanese person working in the arts, how you use these various platforms to give our community a voice?
I think that the Japanese Australian community is actually in numbers not as small as we think, but there is a language issue with many of the first generation people. So they might not be so interested in text-based works like theater or indeed radio, but their children who are mixed heritage or people like yourselves or Arisa or Terumi, who we call 1.5 generation, who, well, English is the main form of language that these people use. And because of that language gap, much of the heritage is not really being passed down, except for during maybe holidays time that the mixed heritage children or 1.5 children might go to visit their relatives in Japan. Well, I don't think the platform matters. I would take up any platform. that's available to hopefully be able to give a voice to the Japanese experience in Australia. When I say Japanese experience, that includes people who are like third, fourth generation of Nikkei Australians as well. I think that because of the citizenship issue, because of the language difference between the first generation and second generation or 1.5s, there seems to be a disconnect. And that disconnect is also made manifold by the fact that the pre-war Japanese, most of them were sent back to Japan after internment, and ones that stayed hid the fact that they were Japanese because of, you know, after the war, if you were Japanese, you were disliked. So there are many others, for example, that have Anglo surnames and Anglo names, living an Anglo life with actually Japanese heritage that's been hidden. All of these things, I think, needs to have a chance to be aired and brought forward in some sort of public sphere. And for others who haven't had the chance to actually hear others, hear these stories, speak their stories.
I think one of the things I took away from this performance was Murakami's determination. Murakami displayed uniquely Japanese values such as ganbaru, like work really hard. And I think that that's really reflective within a lot of the people in the Japanese community right now in contemporary society. But I guess we're not as vocal about what we do in our everyday lives or within our projects. And I think that's strength and determination, which has been displayed historically through people like Murakami, was something that I really took away and kind of made me think about the way that I exist within the Australian community.
I'd like to know more about that. I'm just going to say that my work is, it's doing pretty well, despite the fact that it's like really minority, niche work, but it's done well, despite. You work in a mainstream institution in the arts. And here we are, we're having a conversation. I feel like I'm a very, very minor artist. I'm talking to someone who comes into contact with all the great artists of the world. But we found something to connect through. And yeah, I'd like to find out more about that.
I think that due to my upbringing in the 90s, I think assimilation was a very big part of existing in Australia. And so I didn't go to a Japanese school, Saturday school. I avoided speaking to my parents in Japanese, especially when I was growing up. And I really regret that, of course. But I think that I took every opportunity to push my Japanese heritage aside to belong in this Australian community. And it's only through working in the arts, actually specifically the first time I engaged quite extensively with other artists, arts practitioners, performers from the Japanese community was in, I think, 2016, where I was producing all of the public programs for the Tsukioka Yoshitoshi 100 Aspects of the Moon exhibition. And it was only through this exhibition that I realized how I can contribute to the arts community in Australia and connect with people like you, of course, Arisa, and I guess understand from the sort of creative perspective of the enormous amount of creative talent that's out there in Australia. And I think that it's just become a real passion of mine, and it's really helped me to understand my heritage. It's helped me to understand how I can contribute to the broader arts and cultural sector, not just now, but into the future as well.
That was Yuki Kawakami speaking with artist Mayu Kanamori. The music you heard was Glimpse of Eternity by Maidan and Clatter and Creek by Null Teal Records under the Creative Commons License 4. And you'll find more info in our show notes below. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as we've enjoyed making it. And please check out our other exciting interviews from Diversity Arts' Colour Cycle podcast and other conversations with pioneering artists from culturally diverse backgrounds. This interview was recorded by Yuki Kawakami and produced by Najet El Gauli on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. I'm Lena Nahluz from Diversity Arts Australia, and thanks for joining me. See you next time.